You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 325, our 38th Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike.
Is that for real? Like, we've done 38 of these?
38 in 5 years.
That's just crazy. Yeah, Okay. I'm terrible at math, but let's see. That's how many a year? Let's see. If it was 5 a year, or if it was 50, it'd be 10 a year. Is that right? Again, I'm terrible at math.
No, I want to hear your logic. I want to hear your
No, I'm just wondering how many we do a year, you know, and if it's like a low number, then we should do more.
Well, we've done almost 40 and we've done it for 5 years. So what's 40 divided by 5?
That's a little less than 10 a year. Okay. Is that right?
Yeah. It's about 8-ish a year.
And there's 52 weeks. So what's the percentage there? That's like, yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to get my calculator out. This is embarrassing, but yeah, maybe we should do a couple more of these a year. I don't know. Make it 10 a year. That's not a bad number.
No. Yeah. I mean, we initially planned to do this like once every 4 to 6 episodes, and we've hit that mark. So about 8.
All right. Well,
is roughly.
If you say so, then that makes me feel good. I feel better now.
Well, Mike, we need to let everybody know we've got some more sad news besides the conference being canceled. The cruise is now canceled.
Yep. Yeah, and you know, honestly, it's the right thing to do. So it's the safest course, and I think pragmatically, you know, where people have already and would find themselves, you know, at even in October, it's probably the best thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. The cruise line went ahead and canceled it, so mm-hmm. you know, I guess they're taking a beating because they're the ones that canceled it, not us. But I mean, we would.
We need them.
Mike, we can get a little rowboat or something. And
right. There you go. We'll start working on that right now.
All right. Yeah. Sounds good. All right. Well, we just wanted to let everybody know, again, if you haven't heard, the Naked Bible Cruise in October has been canceled. So hopefully the world gets back to normal next year, Mike.
Yep. Yeah, well, that's what we're hoping. We're just, you know, move everything up a calendar year and plan accordingly, just like it was 2020, except it'll be 2021.
Anything else going on in Florida? Y'all opening
back up? They are opening back up. I mean, I have sad personal news, but it's not Florida related. But yesterday... And I've alluded to this woman before, the woman who basically introduced me to the Lord, you know, through her son, this 9-year-old, you know, kid that would live next to my grandma's, you know, that was really my first introduction to the gospel. She passed away. So she would have been, you know, around my mom's age. My mom is in her low 80s. So maybe a little younger than that, but she was in failing health. So I saw on Facebook that she had passed away. I don't go to Facebook that often, but you know, friends of course do. And my wife let me know that my friend whose name is Brian, I mean, he's the namesake for the main character in my novels. You know, he had posted that his mom had passed away, and I knew she was really, you know, failing. That they live in PA. So that's sad, but at the same time, you know, she's with the Lord. You know, it's just unfortunate, you know, that I don't live in my hometown, you know, you know, to have been able to see her, but you know, we'll see her again, but it's just kind of a downer. You know, yesterday I was doing an interview and for some reason, you know, I thought of her and, you know, mentioned again, as I've done on many interviews and, you know, here and there as I speak, you know, her role and his role, you know, in my own life. And so then we have, you know, later on that night, you know, my wife let me know, you know, what had been posted. So it's sad, but, you know, good at the same time that she's with the Lord.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, our prayers are out to her family and,
yep.
like you said, we'll see her again.
Yep. Just, you know, just despite their difficulties, you know, she, you know, she's just a good example of doing, you know, here's a woman, four kids, two of them have cystic fibrosis, you know, just struggling, you know, every day. But, you know, she's in the right place. She's got this kid next door who's, you know, doesn't know the Lord. That would be me. And, you know, her and her son talk to me about the Lord. I mean, you just do what, you know, is you're capable of doing, you know, and you never know what the ripple effect is. So a lot of times people worry about, you know, they equate serving the Lord with doing something visible or, you know, that has, you know, numbers to it. It's just really the wrong way to think about the Christian life and just, you know, ministry in general. You can do ministry every day, you know, no matter where you're at. Well, I wanted to mention it, you know, just so that people know, because like I said, I do mention her from time to time. Her name was Carol, but just wanted everybody to know that, because they might see, you know, my note to this guy on Facebook. I mean, who knows? But since I mentioned her, you know, I just wanted to say something. But, you know, like I said, she, you know, I think it's fair to say, I mean, how do I put this, you know, without making it sound like I have too bloated a view of what we're doing here. But I mean, look at the ripple effect. So I think that she'll, you know, I wasn't the only, you know, only kid or only person I'm sure that, you know, she led to the Lord, but it's not going to shock me. It doesn't, you know, surprise me at all to think that, you know, the Lord's going to tell her she did well.
You know, put that in perspective, just think of the one person that, yep, out there that you can bring to the Lord and think about what that one person can later go on to achieve and, yeah, you know, I mean, the lives they can, yeah, impact just like you and, you know, right, this show. And
One person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or that one person is the person who does impact that other person. You know, you just never know.
Yeah. You don't.
You know, you just, we're back to just do your job. Do your job. It's absolutely so simple.
Well, Mike, I'm going to transition the best I can from that and talk about something a little bit happier. I just got notified that somebody bought a mask, Naked Bible Podcast mask. And I was like, what is that?
Oh,
but I went and looked on our store and, you know, they have a new, merchandise apparel. It's mask. You could actually go buy mask with our logo on there and, you know, all of the things that we sell. So somebody bought two Naked Bible Podcast mask. That's hilarious.
I got to get that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. That's what I'm doing right after the show.
Yeah, they're $15, so.
I don't care what they are. I got to get that.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
Absolutely. I'm going to have to get one too. and when you get yours, Mike, you're going to have to take a picture of it, you wearing your mask.
Oh, yeah. No, we will.
Yeah,
I'll get them awesome for the pugs too. You know, we'll just wrap them around the pugs. Gosh, and there you go.
That's awesome. That is awesome. All right. Well,
that is perfect.
Yeah. Yes, sir. All right. Well, let's just transition into our questions. We've got several good answers and from you, hopefully, but several good questions. And our first one's going to be from Michelle. And she has loved and collected dragons for about 20 years. I have about 100 statues and plushies around my house. I can't quite put my finger on why, though I find them enchanting and enjoy the mystery around them. I prefer to think of them as benevolent creatures. As you well know, dragons are often associated with evil or with Satan. In the past few years, I can't help but wonder if I am disrespecting God in some way by liking them so much. On one hand, He created all things, so in theory, if they were ever real, it could be reason that God created them. On the other hand, there is the association with evil. Should I be beating myself up so much over this collection, or should I let it all go for my Lord?
Well, I think you should throw them all away except for the Godzilla ones and send those to me.
You know, and me.
So, yeah. Yeah, we should have a good Godzilla model right here, you know, somewhere, or maybe on the Fringe Pop Studio. No, I don't think you should worry about it unless you have some sort of spiritual fascination with it. And people are going to wonder, well, why does Mike answer that way? Well, a number of reasons. You know, the enemy of God that deceived Eve wasn't really a snake or a dragon. You know, a lot of negative dragon lore in Christian circles derives from that misguided notion. That's probably obvious to most listeners. You know, another way of saying this is that Revelation 12, that refers to the devil and Satan, the old serpent. I mean, Revelation 12 isn't informing us that the devil was actually a member of the animal kingdom. It's not saying that. And by extension, no other supernatural powers of darkness are really reptiles or dragons. You know, dragons and sea monsters, they are metaphors, you know, for chaos, but why? You know, and what's the thought there? Well, you know, the metaphors for that are really linked to dragons really have to do with the sea. You know, we see this like in Daniel with the beast that rise from the sea and the beast of Revelation, you know, the dragon from the sea. You know, why is it that they're associated with the sea? And by the way, that is really where this comes from. And most of, like, you know, European dragon lore isn't going to have anything to do with this. But putting that aside for the moment, it's associated with the sea again because the sea is a place where humans can't live. It's inhospitable. And it's filled with big creatures that we don't see on land. So we wonder and we let our imaginations fill in the blanks of what those things are. And by extension, they become metaphors for things that are hostile to humanity. Things that are associated with death and so on and so forth. You know, this is how metaphors work. You know, the meaning of the metaphor is going to be constructed and used, you know, by people who are experiencing the world in a certain way. It doesn't have to have an ontological, you know, reality, you know, these connections. You know, a lot of dragon lore is just pure myth itself. And I'm using the word myth in that sentence to mean not true. It's simply not true. I mean, a lot of dragon lore derives from misidentification of whales and discovery of dinosaur skeletons and fossils, that sort of thing. So, having said all that, your apprehension would ultimately be the result of flawed thinking that gave rise to dragon lore. So that's why I'm saying, you know, I don't think you really need, you know, to worry about this. So, you know, I could elaborate. I think you sort of get the hint. I don't think it's dangerous to collect dragon stuff any more than it would be to collect fossils or collect pictures of dinosaur fossils or alligator skins. Don't collect those, or other creatures that the Old Testament, for instance, associated with demons. I mean, here's where it could be. I'm going to be a little silly here, but to illustrate the point, how about goats? You know, goat demons associated with goats. All the goat farmers out there are in league with the devil, right? Like, it's just ridiculous. How about owls and hawks? You know, Isaiah 34:11. You know, you get birds of prey mentioned, you know, in places that are associated with chaos and demonic creatures. Well, then you must be in league with the devil if you're into falconry or if you work in a raptor clinic. You know, I could go on and on with these sorts of examples. These objects don't mean the same thing to us. They don't have the same metaphorical impact, and our thinking about these things wouldn't really contribute, you know, to the metaphors that we might have to convey the notion of chaos and evil. So I don't think we need to, you know, react in this way, in the way that you're being fearful of in relation to this. But again, that's all predicated on your own self-evaluation, that you don't have some sort of strange spiritual fascination with them or with the lore itself. But, you know, if that's not evident, I don't think you need to worry about it.
Tim has our next few questions. And Tim from Austin, Texas, asks, is there significance to the fact that Eve says to the serpent, God told her not to touch the fruit and not eat only? Why is there a difference in Genesis 2:17 and 3:3?
Yeah, you know, some commentators see a nuanced distinction here and then try to guess, and that is what they're doing, they're guessing, at what this proposed distinction might mean. For example, let me just flip Wenham over here and read you a little section that he has on this. He says, the slight alterations to God's remarks suggest the woman has already moved slightly away from God toward the serpent's attitude. the Creator's generosity is not being given its full due, and he is being painted as a little harsh and repressive, forbidding the tree even to be touched. Indeed, the way "lest you die" follows "touch" suggests that not just eating it, but touching it might be lethal. That's from Wenham's Genesis commentary. You know, so he presumes a distinction, then he, you know, proceeds to speculate about this. You know, other commentators, and I'm just going to tell people this is where I'm at. They don't see any meaningful difference. In other words, they would say, well, the two descriptions really point to the same idea, and really for a couple of reasons. You know, one, you can't really eat the fruit unless you touch it. Okay? You know, this isn't like a pie eating contest where your hands, you know, you know, eat the fruit of the tree, you know, without touching it. You know, it's kind of silly. It's an absurd picture. Or maybe you can stand under the tree and wait for it to drop into your mouth. You know, don't do that. Well, no, if they're going to violate the command, they have to pluck the fruit. They have to touch the tree. So there's really not much of a distinction here. Again, in my mind, again, I'm in this group. You know, secondly, the lemma here, again, for touching is used in other passages to denote more than touching. I mean, in other words, where the thing commented on is really well beyond just a tactile experience. For instance, in Genesis 20, verse 6, let me just flip to that verse. Here's what we get. This is Genesis 20, verse 6. And the context here is Abraham and Abimelech. You know, that story where, you know, Abraham, you know, lies and says she's, well, it's a shaded half-truth. She's my sister. So in verse 6, we read this, where, you know, God is speaking to Abimelech in a dream about Sarah. He says, "Then God said to him in the dream, 'Yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart.'" You know, Abimelech didn't know that she was married. "I know that you've done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her." Well, obviously, it doesn't mean that God forbade Abimelech from walking up to Sarah and taking one finger and touching her. You know, he prevents him from having sex with her. But nevertheless, the lemma, you know, touch, the same one that occurs back in the Genesis passages, that's used. You get the same thing in Genesis 26, 11, where, again, the verb itself means a lot more than just, you know, a tactile experience. So Abimelech, this is Genesis 26, Abimelech, Isaac and Abimelech, 26, 11. "So Abimelech warned all the people, saying, 'Whoever touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death.'" Well, again, he doesn't mean whoever walks up to them and, you know, puts a pinky on them, you're gonna die. No, it means that whoever harms this person, or again, in the case of you know, Isaac's wife, you know, whoever sleeps with her, you know, so the lemma itself means a lot more than just the act of touching. And I think that needs to be factored into, you know, the situation here in Genesis. So you could very well reason that touching really speaks of violating the original command. That's the point. And again, this is the group I'm in. I don't think there's much of a meaningful difference. And I think it gets a little absurd, you know, if you sort of extrapolate out. How would you violate the command without touching it? You know, like I said, stand under the tree and wait till one, you know, drops into your mouth. You know, no, you know, it's just kind of obvious. If you're going to eat this, you got to touch the tree. You got to pluck the fruit off. That's the way you violate it.
Tim's second question is, what does the Bible actually say about drinking wine? Is teetotalism a biblical concept? Proverbs 23:31 is an often cited verse for abstinence from alcohol. Most concede drunkenness is a sin, but if drinking is permitted in moderation, how do you define drunkenness? What did ancient writers have to say on this matter? If moderate drinking is allowed, then what would the Bible say about the moderate use of cannabis or other substances?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Bible doesn't condemn the consumption of alcohol, It doesn't express as a command, you know, teetotalism. You know, the consumption of alcohol, you know, in moderate amounts is allowed. you know, there's really no way to do justice to this topic in a Q&A. It's actually quite a large topic. You know, you get into fermentation techniques. Basically, because of our technology, the alcohol we produce is much stronger than in biblical days. And most of what we would, you know, have as alcohol would fall under the, quote, strong drink warning, which is different than wine in wisdom texts. You know, and this, you know, even in our, in the modern world, we have this technological issue. You know, in the Reconstruction era, the late 19th century, one of the reasons why there was this big prohibition movement in the Reconstruction era on into the Progressive era was because the technology changed. The alcohol got stronger, a lot stronger, you know, and so it led to all sorts of social problems, you know, hence the big emphasis on prohibition. You know, so there, we can actually go back in our own really immediate history and see, you know, how this, you know, would have mattered. It's really going to matter when we compare what we have now back to the ancient world. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, sub trajectories in this topic beyond just the exegetical issues of the passage. There's a lot to think about here. You know, the arguments that people try to make, and I'm quite familiar with the teetotaler argument because my first context as a believer was fundamentalism. But to be honest with you, the arguments that are made on behalf of that view are really weak. The important, you know, issue, of course, the important line not to cross is drunkenness. But again, like you say, you know, how do we define that? Well, I would personally, and you know, just as a, on a personal note here, I don't drink alcohol at all. This will shock some listeners, but I have never tasted beer. I can't even stand the smell of it. Part of the reason is probably because I grew up in an alcoholic home. You know, I didn't need a preacher to tell me to not do that. I've never had any sort of desire or inclination for it. You know, I just don't do it. You know, my wife, you know, will have, you know, some wine or something. I don't extrapolate from my predilection, you know, over to everybody else, you know, under my roof. But again, backtracking to the subject, you know, one of the things that if I were having this discussion with somebody who was living, you know, in my house, I would say, hey, you know, you need to consider 1 Corinthians 6:12. You know, when you're talking about how do we know, you know, we might sort of be getting to this line that you know, is admittedly, you know, not perfectly easy, you know, to define, but this is the passage where Paul says, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be dominated by anything. And you know, he's basically saying, I'm not going to be under the control of any of anything. Okay, I want to be in control of my faculties, you know, who I am, what I'm doing, what I'm thinking, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so I think that's actually a good touch point to help maybe define, at least, you know, in practice, you know, try to define, you know, what's meant, what we mean by buzzed condition, you know, like you described. Well, you know, do you really have control over what you're, is beginning to affect your vision, your thinking, you know, all this kind of stuff. So I think that's a worthwhile thing to sort of loop into the discussion. I think the same thing applies to drugs, though I think the ancient association of drugs with demonic presence and demonic solicitation would have made the drug issue sort of more of an issue in antiquity. But even that really, you know, goes to intent. And I'll try to unpack that real quickly. So basically, you know, the drugs were more powerful or maybe it would get you more quickly to an altered state of consciousness, whose effects would include visionary experiences, you know, leading people to believe they were contacting spiritual presences, and hence the sinister association in antiquity between, you know, drug use and the spirit world. You know, plant-based drugs are among the prohibited practices with respect to what English translations loosely call sorcery. I mean, there are lemmas that specifically target plant-based drugs. You know, again, the context of those things is solicitation. It's divination. It's trying to contact the other side, you know, to get information or contact the dead or whatever. And so these things that would produce altered states of consciousness were thought to assist that process, and hence they get condemned. So, you know, if you go to Deuteronomy 18:10, 10 and 11. Let me just go there and read it quickly because I don't want to garble it here. There shall not be found among you anyone who burns his son or his daughter as an offering, anyone who practices divination or tells fortunes or interprets omens, or a sorcerer, or a charmer, or a medium, or a necromancer, or one who inquires of the dead. Now, for our discussion purposes, the two Hebrew terms that are underneath sorcerer and charmer are the issue. Now, I'm going to read you a little real quick section here from Ann Jeffer's book, Magic and Divination in Ancient Palestine and Syria. This is a 1996 work put out by Brill. I don't know that it's in print anymore, and if it is, it's going to be a few hundred dollars. But this is the major study on magic and divination. So she writes, this term, and she's talking about the first one here, the one that's translated sorcerer, which is mekasef, or the lemma is kasaf. This term is most frequently translated sorcery, but comparative terminology in other Semitic languages points us in the direction of one who concocts potions from plants or an herbalist. Scholars generally agree that the root, you know, for the second one, which is kavar, refers to the use of charms and spells, since the root conveys the idea of uniting, joining, and weaving. Kavar is a lemma that means to join, you know, to put together. Which may be, back to Jeffers, which may by extension speak of the practice of tying or wrapping magical knots or threads around people or objects, or again, to put ingredients together, again, to create these charms, again, whatever they are. So you have a few things there, and you say, oh, you know, what if I'm an herbalist? You know, good grief, you know, I grow herbs in my backyard. You know, I need to repent. Now, again, consider the context. The context is divination. And the reason that it gets the association is, again, producing altered states to, you know, experience the spiritual world. That kind of thing is condemned. So, again, I don't know. I mean, I can read, you know, what the effects of this or that drug are. But I guess I would question the wisdom. You know, we do have wisdom texts in the Bible. You know, this is why we have them. Wisdom texts are not flat out do's and don'ts. They are flat out, well, if you do this, it might be really stupid. Or if you don't do that, it might be unwise. You know, this is the sort of thing that you have to consider. Why would you fiddle with it? You know, why would you fiddle with it? I mean, I do know because of my home. I mean, I not only grew up in an alcoholic household, but I had at least one stepbrother who was really into drugs. When my dad did get sober, which happened when we were in junior high, and he never touched, you know, alcohol, you know, up to then, you know, to his death, you know, a couple of years ago. But we had a steady stream. You know, my dad had a real soft spot for people who were in this, who were addicted. And so he had a construction business that I worked for 3 years, and we had a steady stream of people from jail, people from halfway houses, people from AA come through. He would give them jobs. And, you know, sad to say, most of them never made it, you know, and they would tell you, I mean, they would tell us, you know, the kids that, you know, my dad's kids, don't do pot. That's where I started. I mean, I must have heard that 100 times. You know, and okay, dude, you're the one that's addicted, so I guess I'll consider you an authority. You know, so I mean, it just, why do we want to experiment with this stuff? I just don't get it. I don't see how it's wise. Okay, that's a key thought. Wisdom. You know, if all you're concerned about is the black and white do's and don'ts, frankly, that's unwise. All right, wisdom. Material, just wisdom living in general, isn't equatable with just the strict do's and don'ts. It's make good decisions. Is this a good decision? So again, my own personal experience, even though I've never done this stuff, I've probably seen a lifetime or two of it. Again, not direct experience, but just seeing how it destroys people. So I would just question, again, how is this wise? You know, in the New Testament, you get Galatians 5:20, pharmakeia. Again, this is also equated with sorcery. You know, Paul mentions, he actually uses this word a couple times. Galatians 5:20 is one. It's in a list of vices. You know, sorcery, I'm going to read a little bit here since I want to give the New Testament fair time here. This is from Moo's commentary in Galatians. Sorcery translates the word pharmakeia, whose similarity to our English pharmacy reveals its basic meaning of dispensing drugs for medicinal purposes. In the Greek of our literature, however, you know, New Testament era, it has a negative sense, referring either to the administration of poison, and he cites something from Josephus, or to the use of drugs in magical practices, and by extension, to those practices themselves. The word is used of the, quote, secret arts of the Egyptian magicians in the Septuagint, Exodus 7:11, 22, chapter 8, 3 and 14. You know, so on and so forth. He has a bunch of cross references here. So again, it has this association, but that doesn't mean if you're a pharmacist, you need to repent. Okay, these things, these statements, these ideas are in the context of divination and, you know, idolatry, soliciting the other side, so on and so forth. So we have to consider that context for them, which really, in my head, takes us to wisdom living. And again, my question would be is, how is this wise? You know, explain that to me. And wise doesn't mean, well, I just want to try it. Again, I'll repeat the question. How is this wise? I didn't ask you how is it pleasurable. I asked you how is it wise? Totally different question.
Mike, I've never had beer either.
Right, right.
I'll tell you, I've had some unwise moments in my college days. So.
I'm sure you have. Shout I know out lots of people who have.
Texas Tech.
Shout out.
We'll move on from that. But Tim,
I'll let you edit that out and extricate yourselves.
No, I'll leave it in there. I'm all right. I'm all right. All right. I'm all right. There's nothing wrong with that. I own my mistakes. You know, that's how you
there
learn.
There you go.
You got to make mistakes in order to learn. So
that's good. Yep. And I watched lots of people make lots of mistakes.
Yeah. And hopefully
some of them ended very badly.
Yeah. And hopefully you can learn from those mistakes. So, mm-hmm. All right. Tim's next question is, what is the significance of Noah sending out a raven before the dove?
Yeah, boy, this actually can get pretty long here. And you say, well, good grief. It's just a question on a raven and a dove. Yeah, I know. But my answer here is influenced by something James Bijon wrote, and it's Bejon. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing the name correctly, but he has a lengthy paper. And I know he listens to the podcast. He's a scholar associated with Tyndale Haas. But he has a wonderful paper online that you can get at academia.edu. It's called Toward a Theology of Jubilee. And I just heartily recommend this. It's really good stuff. So I want to read a little bit of this, you know, because I think what he says in this, believe it or not, he loops the raven and the dove into this whole thing about Jubilee, and just takes a little while to get there, but it's really cool. So to appreciate this, you have to realize that Jubilee and the Day of Atonement are intertwined. Okay, so James gets into the Day of Atonement in his paper about the Jubilee and the messaging of the Day of Atonement. And it's in all sorts of places. He has a section entitled The Day of Atonement's Relationship to the Flood. And so I want to read you some excerpts from that. He writes, in the context of Genesis, the flood can be seen as a worldwide day of atonement, as a sequence of events which purges and purifies Yahweh's temple, in other words, his creation. In Genesis 1, Yahweh's cosmic order is established, and it's his temple. Creation's elements are separated out and assigned their boundaries as a formless and disordered world is turned into a very good creation. Yet with man's fall comes death and disorder. The events of Genesis 6 spell out the culmination of and the last straw in this process. The backdrop to Genesis 6 is the death brought about by sin, as it is in the account of the Day of Atonement. The narrative proper begins with an account of a forbidden mixture of seeds. A group of angelic entities depart from their divinely appointed positions and enter into the realm of mankind. Their intention, which they soon accomplish, is to mix their seed with mankind. In other words, to cross a boundary which Yahweh alone can lawfully cross, since heavenly and earthly seeds may only be fused by God. The result of the angels' actions is, therefore, pollution. Yahweh's spirit will not continue to strive with man on the earth indefinitely. The world's telos, its end goal, has been fundamentally and dramatically disturbed, and purification must be made. The imbalance between the creation and its original state is vast, hence Yahweh's grief. Yahweh even begins to regret his decision to create mankind. Put another way, the tension in creation results in an apparent tension in Yahweh's view of his creation. The earth is not filled with Adam's seed, as per Yahweh's original command, but with violence. The land is corrupt and in need of purification. Let me just stop there. James has a wonderful footnote in that little section about how the Sethite view just doesn't make any sense. So thank you, James. But back to the flood and the Day of Atonement stuff. So we have this, again, descent into pollution, and it needs to be fixed. So as if in answer, a number of linguistic allusions to priestly activity occur in the text. A man without blemish, okay, this would be Noah, a distinctly cultic term, is called out from the midst of the world's impure generations. Yahweh gives his chosen, Noah, Noahite priest, strict orders. He is to construct an ark, to coat it with pitch. These are, by the way, he says, these are homophonies of the verb to atone. The word for to coat things and the word for pitch sound like the lemma for atone. And he is to distinguish clean from unclean animals. Later, these animals will be brought to Noah, as they will be to Israel's high priest. And again, start thinking about the flood story and what priests do in the Day of Atonement. And this is James's point. Look at these parallels. Furthermore, Noah and his sons are to spend 7 days in the ark before the flood, before the work of atonement begins, just as Aaron and his sons will be required to remain in the tabernacle for the course of their 7-day ordination. Analogies can also be drawn between the ark and Solomon's temple. I'm going to skip this part because, I mean, he has a couple paragraphs of that. Again, it's just fascinating. To skip ahead, he says, just as on the Day of Atonement, Israel's pollution is returned to the formless wilderness where it belongs and from whence Israel has been called forth, so in the year of the flood, the world's pollution is returned to the formless deep where it belongs and from whence the land has been called forth. As such, the flood is a cosmic reboot. In its aftermath, a cleansed land reemerges from the chaotic waters, you know, just like at the beginning. Skip a little ahead again. He says, further hints of the Day of Atonement are also latent in the flood narrative. Consider, for instance, the two goats involved in the Day of Atonement ritual. One is sent into Yahweh's presence and ascends into the heavens in the form of the ascension sacrifice, while the other is sent out of Yahweh's presence to a decreational realm of dust and formlessness. Likewise, in the flood narrative, okay, here we are, here we get into the birds here. Likewise, in the flood narrative, Noah and his family ascend into the heavens as the ark is borne upwards on the surface of the waters, while a fallen world sinks down into the depths of those same waters. The same pattern can be identified in Noah's dispatch of a raven and a dove. The raven, which is an unclean animal, is sent out into a world still in the grip of decreation, never to return. By way of contrast, the dove, a clean animal, remains in God's presence in the ark and later enters into Yahweh's new creation. Now, if you keep reading in this, he has a wonderful chiasm to illustrate, you know, the points of this. I mean, it's just good stuff. It's really good literary analysis. And to get to the point, in the context of decreation and the creation, you know, this fixing the pollution, decreation and the recreation of the earth in the flood, it makes sense to me that the unclean animal, the raven, would not return, but the dove does. And the dove returns with the sign of life, new creation, and then goes off to live in the new world. So, yeah, I think even the raven plays a role in the theological messaging. So that's how I would answer that.
Tim's next question is, when planting, is ordination a requirement? Speaking of the laying on of hands or confirmation from the congregation or elders, as my understanding is God ordains, men confirm ordination. In reference to church planting, is the biblical idea that churches can only legitimately be sent out from existing churches, or can one be established without technically being sent out?
Yeah, okay, so this is about church planting. Well, I don't know, and please pardon the pun, I don't know that the Bible ordains a specific process of ordination. That would be hard to demonstrate in terms of all the specifics, you know, all the procedural kinds of things that we're used to today. But that said, ordination serves a pretty useful purpose, and it makes sense. You know, is the person doctrinally sound? Well, we think that's the case, and so we identify with that person and commission them via the laying on of hands. So it's a public sign and a personal connection. Now, having said that, I usually process questions like this by asking the negative. So let's say someone out in the hinterlands somewhere in the world, you know, feels led by God to start a church, a group of believers who gather for fellowship, they gather for encouragement, they learn scripture together, all those things, and they help others. They do ministry and they do evangelism, whatever, and the group grows. Now, if the Lord came back in the middle of all of that, do we really think that the Lord would say to the guy who started this church, hey, that was a nice thought, but your ministry was illegitimate. Sorry, no reward there. You weren't ordained. I don't believe that for a minute. Okay, I think it's nonsense to think that. This is why, again, when I get these kind of questions, well, if the answer to this is you know, X, well, then what else must be true? You know, what are the exceptions? And I think in this case, it's pretty clear. You got some guy who doesn't have anybody to ordain him, any church body, any even individual church. I mean, he comes to the Lord, you know, hey, I need fellowship. You know, maybe he's out there on the internet discovering what a church is. And boy, we need one of those. I need to find other believers, or I need to win people to the Lord, and then we can gather together. And he does that, and it grows, and it's wonderful. It's a blessing. When the Lord comes back, he's not going to say, dude, you weren't ordained. Sorry. It's ridiculous. Okay, so that's the way I would answer the question. You know, given the absence of that sort of situation, you know, if it's sort of in a normal situation where there's lots of opportunities to be ordained, or you know, have someone, you know, check your theology or whatever, you know, in that sort of situation, I guess I'd want to know why anyone would have a problem with being ordained. Why would you seek to avoid it? What's the problem with being accountable, you know, to other believers and also being known, you know, by other believers as being, you know, who are in the ministry? They and you know, you're letting them know that you're having a, you know, doing a ministry or starting a church. I mean, because they can be helpful. They can be a sounding board. They can just have conversations, good advice. I mean, why would you not want that? So it's a question of accountability and then help. And ordination, again, even an informal, you know, kind of thing. I mean, some are really, really, really formal. Some denominations have long, you know, formalities about this, long processes. But again, what they're trying to do is they're trying to answer questions. Are you doctrinally sound? And so on and so forth. Just generally speaking, I'm not talking about any particular process. Why would that be something to avoid? And on the positive side of it, the benefits of an ordination sort of relationship, however that looks, why would that be something to avoid? I don't really see why we would want to avoid either, you know, either side of that coin. So if ordination isn't possible in some context, I would say don't let that stop you from starting a church. But if it is possible, don't run from it either. So that's the way I would approach that.
All right, Mike, that's all the questions we have for today. So we appreciate everybody that sent in their questions. And again, you can email me at treystrickland@gmail.com or trey@nakedbible.com with your questions. And we'll get them answered hopefully over time. Mike, we've still got a lot of backlog of questions to get to. So
got two more to go to hit the magic number of 40.
Yeah, two more to go.
Maybe you can look through all the questions that are about the number 40.
Yeah, because I've got lots of time to do that. Let me just...
Yeah, there you go.
Search my database of...
Yeah, it might drive you to drink, you know, so...
Hey now. It doesn't take a lot. It doesn't take a lot.
That would be my fault,
right? All okay. Right, Mike. Well, we appreciate you answering our questions and everybody sending in those questions. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.